You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. But are your bills accurate? It's estimated over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help. HealthLock technology securely connects with your insurance and flags any overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. To save, visit HealthLock.com today.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, hello there. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am your host, Liv, back with returning guest, C.W. Marshall, also known as Toph. Toph joined me from UBC, which is always such a thrill. It is just over the water from where I live. And we talked about theater. Just theater. I specifically asked Toph to come back to talk about this because I have had so many incredible questions from all of you, both on my Patreon really specifically and elsewhere, but just about the culture behind ancient Greek theater, the festivals, the ways in which these plays were performed, who funded them, why, what was the whole, like the actual real people aspects of this ancient entertainment, the ancient tragedy, but theater broadly. We do talk about the comedians as well. Aristophanes, fine. But we had, this was an incredible conversation. Oh my God, I learned so much, and it did inspire me to next summer. We're going to do a whole month on Euripides, like both some plays, but also the person, the culture, him as a tragedian and his, cannot wait. Anyway, that's for future time. Today is just about theater itself. So many fascinating intricacies and details about the culture of it. I won't try to say more because the conversation is just too good. Conversations, a peek behind the ancient scenes, the culture of theater with C.W. Marshall. I'm so thrilled to have you back, for one, but also just, yeah, Greek tragedy broadly. I've already talked outside of the episode about how obsessed I am with Euripides. But I just, you know, I think something that listeners don't often understand without the background of this is the fuller context of Athenian tragedy, I should say, rather than Greek, but of, you know, what was kind of going on, the festivals where these were performed, the fact that there were so many tragedians whose work doesn't survive, you know, all of the wins and losses and content or contests and sort of everything. So
I eat that stuff up.
Good. That's why I have you. It's very exciting. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe starting with the festivals and maybe the creation of the plays themselves. So you mentioned funding. I'd love to hear more about sort of the logistical aspects of how these things were created, you know, for what like original kind of purpose. Is that enough of a prompt?
Great. There we go. Well, it's great to be here. So the festivals, one thing we know about Athenian tragedy is that it was performed at festivals. And we know about the city Dionysia. And generally, we tend to think that the city Dionysia was it, that when the tragedians were putting plays forward, they were putting them forward in groups of four, three tragedies with a satyr play. Sometimes people argue that maybe the satyr play wasn't always fourth, but I think it was always fourth. That the experience of watching tragedy at the Dionysia, which was this festival that was held roughly in March, was to see all four of these plays as a unit. They might not have been narratively connected, but if they weren't narratively connected, they could have been thematically connected. We know that Euripides' plays in 415 were all linked with the Trojan War. But I also think that sometimes they were intertextually connected, mm-hmm. that if Cyclops was performed as the satyr play in 408 with Orestes, for example, if you look at the plays that they're alluding to, both Orestes and Cyclops are engaging with Eurystheia. Both of them are engaging with Hecuba. Both of them are engaging with the same set of sort of paratexts. And so I think at different times, the playwrights try different ways of connecting their plays up. But that's just one festival. And the bit that starts to be really fun to think about is when we realize that the playwrights put on plays at other festivals too. Mm-hmm. In addition to the March festival of the Dionysia, there was a festival in January. And that's the Dionysia. The Linnaea. And the Linnaea festival, we're not completely confident we know where it was staged. We can talk about theater spaces later if you want. But the Linnaea, we tend to think of as a comic festival because we know we've got plays of Aristophanes that were performed at the Linnaea. The Frogs was performed at the Linnaea. The Acharnians was performed at the Linnaea. But there was also a tragic competition at the Linnaea. And it appears, based on epigraphic records that survive, that there would only be two competitors, and that they'd put forward a pair of tragedies. Mm-hmm. So no satyr plays, but just two tragedies back to back. And that was what was voted on for the tragic competition at the Linnaea. The Linnaea competition started probably in the 440s. So the Dionysia had been going full tilt for 50, 60 years at this point. We've got this festival, but they wanted to have more theater in their lives over the course of the year. And so they set up this other competition. And while our records tend to foreground the comedies, just because we've got plays by Aristophanes and he's got a lot of support materials behind him, we know that there was a tragic competition at the Linnaea too. So if we start thinking about the number of tragedies that are getting performed in a year, we've got three tragedies from three competitors. That's nine at the Dionysia and two by two at the Linnaea. So 13 new tragedies every year. Is 4 in 13 of the tragedies that survive from us Linnaea plays? It might not be that high, but I think there's good reason to think that maybe some of the tragedies that we've got aren't Dionysia plays at all.
Yeah.
And that some of them were performed at the Linnaea or maybe at another festival, because there were also local Dionysia festivals also earlier in the year. Now, these are sometimes called rural Dionysia. Sometimes they're called deme Dionysia. Athens was divided into 139 or whatever demes, villages or neighborhoods, and some of them had theater spaces. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about individual theater spaces if you want, but if you ever go to Attica and you're heading down south to the Temple of Sunion, on the coast, really close to there, is the Deem Theater of Thorikos. Mm. And Thorikos is...
Someone told me about this. Yes.
Yeah, I know. You've got to go. It's amazing.
I know.
So Thorikos, it's just, you know, on the side of the road. Sometimes the gates just ajar. Sometimes it's a little person sitting in a house. But you go in.
Love Greece
and
for that.
There's... But here's a 5th century theater space for us. It's one of these Deem theater spaces. And it was a theater space that was probably used by Thorikos and the neighboring Deems as well for their Dionysia. They may have pooled together, but we've got inscriptional records saying that there were dramatic contests there too. We don't know all the workings of them. But if there's, let's say, a dozen different Deem festivals scattered around Attica too during this local Dionysia celebration or rural Dionysia celebration, that adds even more plays. Mm-hmm. I'll talk a little bit more about Thorikos just for a sec, because it's right by the entry to the Laurion silver mines. It's this long sort of rectangular orchestra. The grounds drops off quickly, so there's barely room to set up a stage building. And if you do set up a stage building, that makes the orchestra even more narrow. But it's not this gorgeous, perfect circle or whatever we might imagine. It's just the local countryside, and this was the space that they had to build a theater. And they built it. It's preserved. It's being excavated. And it's a great place to visit, just for breaking away from the assumptions that we get when we just look at the Theater of Dionysus or just look at Epidavros.
Yeah. So many quick things based on what you've said. One, so I remember Thorikos was mentioned by Hannah Parker, came on my show. She does TikToks, amazing TikToks about the ancient world. And she mentioned it because she had just been there. And is it like, it's oddly shaped, right? Because of what you're talking about, how it was just like they just used what they had and created what they could. So it's quite unique, is it?
It's almost like a J that's on its side. Huh. So there's a long row of seats that sort of curve over on one side and one side only. There's room for a temple on the other side. But it's not even symmetrical.
Interesting.
And yet it was a site of theater competitions. Yeah. And we've got these great records that just scattered hints throughout antiquity. But for example, I think it's Aelian writing in Rome. He's got this anecdote of Socrates, famous Socrates, going to the Piraeus whenever Euripides puts on a play there.
Good.
It's a weird thing to invent.
Yeah.
You're not going to make that up. But it suggests that, at least in Aelian's day, it would be assumed that one of the big three, Euripides, would be regularly, at least more than once, putting on plays at this one particular Deem festival. There's another theater in the Piraeus, but that Socrates, the point of the anecdote is that Socrates was a big Euripides fan, and he's going to walk all the way down to the harbor in order to see a Euripides play. It's not weird that Euripides is putting on a play there. That has to be presumed for the story to be interesting. So again, do we have records of Euripides actually performing there? No, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if all of the playwrights were occasionally, maybe they've only got one or two plays that they've written in that year that they want to put on that aren't working as a tetralogy, that aren't Dionysia plays, that someone else got selected for the Dionysia, so they're going to put two of the plays on at the Linnaea. Or maybe they just get paid really, really well to go down to the Piraeus. But I think we need to break free of this assumption that, you know, you're trying out material in the Catskills before you bring it to the big city, or that it's an encore performance. If you win, you get to tour the provinces. I think neither of those is as likely as just these were opportunities to put on plays, and everyone is putting on plays all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about how many we know each playwright had, like obviously most of them don't survive, but we know so many. Like it seems that logistically, this seems like something that, you'd need more opportunity than just the Dionysia, because if there's, we only know of the plays of these three, well, of course we know about more, but like, you know, we think of these three and the volume that they had, but they weren't always performing every year. They didn't always get in, you know? And so, yeah, like, and So before I forget to ask this, because also apologies if I'm misremembering, but you came on my show to talk about the Helen, which is stuck with me
such
forever. It's incredible. I just started talking about Iphigenia among the Taurians, and the introduction, there's some note about it being like often kind of connected with the Helen in sort of theme. And I'm like, oh, I'm so excited. But did you argue that the Helen and Andromache could have been Linnaea plays, or am I misremembering?
No, you're not. Andromeda.
Sorry, thank you.
I had thought I was going to be arguing that Helen and Andromeda were both Linnaea plays,
yeah,
and that was a doublet. That when I started writing my book on Helen, that's what I thought I was going to be arguing. Unfortunately, I talked myself out of that particular okay. example. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other Linnaea plays in amongst the plays that survive.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's impossible in the case of Helen and Andromeda. I just think the balance of probabilities in that case argues against it.
Interesting.
But I think being open to that possibility is something that I want to be, and I want to recognize the full performance calendar, that sometimes you want to open a play in Chicago rather than New York for various reasons. That sometimes you want to target a particular audience, and that particular audience is going to be found somewhere else.
Yeah. I think as Canadians, we can identify with it.
Just a little bit, maybe. Yeah.
I say, so having been wished happy Thanksgiving multiple times this week.
So we're talking about the big playwrights putting on plays at these DEEM level festivals. Mm-hmm. We actually have a really cool inscription, and we don't know what the inscription means, but I think I can tell you the whole details of the inscription. It was, I think it was found in 1954. It's the base for a bronze statue that was found in a DEEM called Anagyrus. The DEEM is on the coast. You can see the monument itself, or the base itself, in the Epigraphic Museum in Athens, which is just sort of around the side of the big National Archaeological Museum.
Why didn't I know that was a thing? Now I'm mad at myself, but good to know. Okay.
Good to know. I don't use the phrase as exciting as the Epigraphic Museum in Athens often, but but I find it thrilling. But anyway, so in there, there's this monument that was set up by the Choregos, the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Choregos has won. And what he gets to do as a victor is set up a statue to me. Look how awesome I am. And what the what the inscription says is, Socrates dedicated this. Euripides was the didaskalos. Didaskalos is our word for director. Doesn't say Euripides was the playwright.
Huh.
And then it lists the tragedians, tragoidoi, and then it gives 14 names. And so there's a Melitos, there's an Emporion, there's a Lysias, there's a Son. Son is a really rare name in Greek. It's S-O-N. But we know of a Son from Anagyrus, from another inscription. And so these are the local boys who were in a chorus for a tragedy that Euripides directed, and that this guy Socrates, not the famous Socrates, but some other Socrates. And if it wasn't some other Socrates, it was that other Socrates' grandson. So there's a couple of candidates on who the Socrates could be.
Love it.
But Socrates is the producer, we would say. Euripides was the director. And here are 14 choristers. And that's all it says. So look what we can get from this information. First off, no mention of what festival it is. If you're looking at the statue, you can work it out, or you know. That's not what's important.
Yeah.
What's important is that we won. What were the plays? Not important. We don't need to commemorate the playwright at all. And in fact, Euripides isn't commemorated as a playwright.
Yeah.
He's commemorated as Didaskalos. He's a director. With the Oscars, we care more about the best director than the best adapted screenplay.
Yeah.
But here, in terms of the dedications, it's not the poet, the adapted screenplay, it's the director that is being commemorated. And we can make a little aside here if we want. We know in the case of some comedies that Aristophanes, for example, doesn't direct all his own plays.
Mm.
And he gets other people who are specialists. You get, you know, someone who understands this type of comedy to direct this type of a play.
Yeah.
Or maybe when Aristophanes is acting in his plays, he gets another director. We don't know. But anyway, so we know the Choregos, we know the director, we know 14 tragedians. We don't know the festival. We don't know the plays that won. We don't know the actors. The actors aren't being identified on this. They're being paid. They're separate from this. The Choregos, the producer, is only bragging about the stuff that he put forward.
Right.
And so all sorts of information we would want to have,
yeah,
we need to guess at, but it shows us what was important, at least from the production side.
Yeah.
That if you win Best Picture, you always, again, thinking of the Oscars, you know, the crowd of people who come up for Best Picture, you don't know who those people are. Sometimes there's an actor there or two, but the people that you're seeing are the people backstage or the people who have roles that don't make it onto the screen. Yeah. So, is this evidence that there was a dramatic contest at Anagyrus? Maybe. And Benjamin Millis says that this is evidence that Euripides was competing, not early in his career, but late in his career, with a one-off play at Anagyrus, and that he wins.
Yeah.
And maybe it's kept coming in and, you know, maybe it's a little unfair if Euripides comes in at age 65, having won at the Dionysia at least a couple of times, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
so maybe.
I like this idea of the Oscars, because it's a great way to kind of connect it. Like thinking of like Scorsese jumping in with like a bunch of up and coming directors, and you're like, well, that's not totally fair, I guess. Like,
yeah. Or when Scorsese does the Netflix film.
Yeah,
right?
Yes, absolutely. Like
that's exactly right. So did all the choristers come from the same deme? Is that why they're not given their father's names and not given their deme associations? If there were 15 choristers, where's the 15th? Some people have suggested that he was a professional, and so we don't, you know, if we're paying him, or he's the chorus leader, and if we're paying him, he doesn't get his name written down. But it's also possible he just came from another deme, and we don't care about him as much,
yeah.
And that we're only celebrating the local boys. It's also possible that this is celebrating a victory at the Dionysia.
Yeah.
But where we want to brag about it is in our hometown.
Yeah.
So we know that dithyrambic victories get celebrated in the city. If you're representing your tribe, you set up your monument for the dithyram close to the Theater of Dionysus. But maybe for dramas, you don't. Mm-hmm. Maybe for dramas, you brag about winning at the big festival by setting up a statue to yourself,
yeah,
in your hometown, because that's where people are going to go, oh yeah, no, he's one of ours.
Yeah. Or maybe this guy felt like he grew up a loser and he just really specifically wanted to like celebrate himself, and like maybe it wasn't even a tradition. It was just like him being like, nah, I'm gonna make them know. Like...
And I'll say the fragmentary nature of the evidence means we can't tell between those.
Yeah.
But that's exactly right. So so thinking about what the producer gets out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the producer gets that as their payoff. If they win, they get to set up a statue. And that's true whether they're at the Dionysia, whether they're at the Lanaya, or whether they're at a local Dionysia.
Mm-hmm.
But I think recognizing the possibility that our playwrights, particularly Sophocles and Euripides, once there are more and more contests in the second half of the 5th century, with the Lanaya starting, you know, maybe 442, give or take 3 or 4 years, we've got this increasingly busy theater calendar,
mm-hmm,
and they're finding opportunities. They're not always going to be at the Dionysia. And, you know, we happily accept that for the comedians already. We know the comedians split their time. We know the comedians found other directors. Maybe it was more common than we want to think for tragedy as well.
I mean, it makes perfect sense if you think about it in terms of just like general human nature, you know, like, even writers and stuff, like you're gonna write a big novel, but that doesn't mean you're not gonna like write an article here and there. Like, people need to make money, you know. The idea that these playwrights would only produce something once a year as their livelihood seems like kind of unlikely.
But also sometimes you just don't get the publisher that you want, or you might not be selected for the festival, and you want to find alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Got to self-publish.
So just start putting on plays in the Agora and see what happens. But I like thinking in terms of what these roles are. So if the Choregos gets that as their reward, we know that the Choregos sort of gets drafted into this as part of the Athenian tax system.
Hmm.
They are performing a public service by paying for a chorus. It is a choregia, and this is the way elite Athenians show off their wealth, either by sponsoring a chorus or by sponsoring a trireme. Those are the two major ones.
They're so different. That's great.
And there are some boys who will want to support the military and some who will want to support the arts. I think that's always been the case.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
But you're allowed to volunteer if you want, right? We think Pericles volunteered in 472 to produce Aeschylus's Persians and that tetralogy. But, you know, here he is, a young, rich guy. This is the way he's making his introduction to himself. He sees, you know, a likely winner. And he, him in his 20s, he says, look, I'll be the choreographer for this production. And because it wins, he gets cultural capital.
Yeah, it benefited him in the end. Yeah.
he did all right.
Yeah, he did okay.
Yeah. Young Pericles, yeah. So thinking about that in terms of the Athenian tax system, thinking in terms of whether you are conscripted to pay a choregia and whether you're trying to go cheap or whether you fully embrace being selected and you shell out in order to have a better chance at winnings, means that so much of what happens in the production is what the director, the didaskalos, can get out of the choregos. And I imagine that there's always this negotiation between Euripides as director saying, look, I want a second set of costumes.
Yeah.
They've come on as hunters. Now they're going to come on as maidens. It's going to blow their mind. And the choregos is going, well, you know, can we go cheap on the costumes? No, we can't go cheap. You know, and... But those sort of negotiations seem to be, well, endemic in theater that I've been part of.
Yeah.
And it's worth thinking about what, you know, what, who pays for what.
Yeah.
And there's some indications, you know, like who pays for the chorus. The chorus is paid for by the choregos. And that includes the rehearsal time. We've got this this essentially a wrongful death lawsuit. Is it okay to do more legal things? I know that's...
This is great.
So Antiphon is a hired speechwriter who has written one side of a law court speech for a case where a boy chorister has died. So this isn't for a play, but it's for a dithyram. But a boy has been... you know, basically sent away to boarding school for several months to practice singing in this boy's choir. He had a sore throat. He was given something to gargle with and he dies as a result. So who is responsible? Is nobody responsible? Is the boy responsible? Is the guy who gave him the gargle responsible? Is the guy who hired that guy responsible? Or is the choregos who hired the guy who hired the guy who gave him the gargle responsible? And where do we assign legal responsibility for this very unfortunate death of a small child who was just trying to sing better? That speech tells us so much about the rehearsal process for a chorister, just because it's dealing with the in and out, a dithyrambic chorister, but still, you know, we've got these boys who are going off, leaving their homes for extended periods of time to live on somebody's rich estate, to be trained by professionals in order to sing so that their dean or their tribe will have a chance to win the dithyrambic competition. And so again, we can look at these speeches don't answer questions, but they raise all sorts of exciting questions for us. And so that speech gives us some indications of what the choregos pays for in terms of the chorus. He also pays for costumes. And so if we want fancy costumes, if we want lots of extras, if in Helen, when the king shows up, maybe he's riding horses, they're returning victorious from the hunt. How elaborate is the hunt scene? They're only on stage for, you know, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. We don't want to keep all those animals on stage in case things go wrong. But for that brief entry of the king, how magnificent can we make it for how cheap? And I'm sure, again, there's a tension there that the didaskalos and the choregos were negotiating so that when Theoclymenus comes on in Helen, it can be a spectacular entry without having unexpected comic side effects.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I want to know everything. Do we?
So do I.
Right? God. I mean, you were when you were talking about it earlier, the the monument that was set up. It's just, I absolutely love the mysteries involved, like the fact that, you know, he didn't care what the play was, like, you know, this idea that, like, the stuff that we so desperately want to know, we just never will because they didn't care. And that's so fascinating. Like, obviously it's infuriating too, but it's so infuriating too.
But again, we can we can read what certain big studios are doing in terms of releasing or not releasing their films. Things that have been in the news recently in terms of this. It's not the content that the studio cares about. They care about the profit.
Yeah.
The Karagos, in some cases, is going to care about, you know, do I win? What's the play that's going to win? Not what's the play that's going to make the greatest artistic statement, or the one that's going to be entering into the mythographic tradition. Because that's not something that they're framing their thoughts in.
Yeah. It's just so interesting. Do we know any kind of, like, do we have any kind of actual proof examples of, like, of a play that, say, got better funding, that had good costumes, like any of those details?
There's some jokes in Aristophanes that we can interpret that way. So, for example, in Frogs, the chorus has two identities. First, they're frogs, and then they are the initiates, the Eleusinian initiates.
Right.
There's been some discussion as to whether there are singing and dancing frogs in a play called Frogs. I think there are. If there are frogs in Frogs, by which I mean there are people that we see singing and dancing in the orchestra, even though Dionysus doesn't see them, and the comic potential there, I think, is clear. Later on, when the chorus return and they're in torn initiate robes, we've got a joke that's all the Choregos could afford. So some people, without a sense of humor, might say, clearly the frogs didn't appear earlier because the Choregos is poor. Or, though just as plausibly, and I would have said more plausibly, we've just seen elaborate singing flippers and frog costumes, and this is a bonus costume for the rest of the play. And what, these old things? And all of a sudden we get the joke that, of course, the Choregos is shelling out, and the playwright has written into the script that the Choregos is shelling out. You're not going to insult your own Choregos if you're trying to win a prize.
Yeah. I mean, that seems most likely, is that, like, the joke is that the frogs were so elaborate.
Exactly.
Like, oh, well, it's like he prioritized the frogs, and rightly so, you know?
Yeah,
That's really interesting. This might be just like a total leap, but it's the first thing I thought of. My listeners, I'm being funny and I don't even know it. My listeners have asked, like, more about, you know, I've talked briefly about things like the crane, which I'm going to forget what its actual name was.
The mechane, yeah.
Oh my God, it's so easy. Like, duh. like, where we get the word machine? God. So something like that, is that something that sort of always going to go along with plays, or does that depend on the funding?
That's a great, great question, because here's what we know about the mechane. The crane can swing on people either for flying or bring a god on at the end.
Mm-hmm. Or a dragon drawn chariot with dead children.
For Medea. Interestingly, that's the one that has the biggest load that needs to be carried of the extant plays. It's also the earliest of I think, you know, they were a little too ambitious when they were doing that one, and they scaled it back afterwards.
Interesting.
If we were just talking about what the Choregos pays for, does the Choregos pay for the crane? And I think he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
They're all he's, right?
But of course, yeah.
I think he doesn't. I think that if we've got a mechane, that is, you know, we're setting up a crane, is being attached to the skene in order to be solid. That is an expense of the festival.
Mm-hmm.
And if the crane is available in one production, it's available to everyone in that production, or in that festival.
Yeah.
Not just to Euripides. So Now, that's just sort of a common sense thing in that it has to be attached to the skene that everybody is using.
Yeah.
But also, there's reference in Aristophanes at one point in Peace, we call out to the mechane poios, the crane worker. His name is Derek. No. the crane worker, mechane poios, is being given instructions. Is he part of the production team, or is he part of, let's say, the theater building in-house staff?
Yeah.
And I think he's the latter. I think the mechane poios is, how many times do you have to rehearse in the theater itself? Mm. We don't know of anyone rehearsing in the theater itself. Mm. You don't want to give away surprises and things like that.
Yeah, it's totally open.
But they do have the festival has someone who works the crane. And if you want the crane as part of your production, you let the Archon know at the beginning of the year. You then tell everybody who's competing that year, oh, there's a crane. Did they build a crane every festival? They maybe did. Maybe it was a default at the Dionysia that there was a crane every year. Maybe it was just every 2 years. And maybe that might be a reason you didn't put in 1 year because you got a spectacular crane ending that you want. And they're just not shelling out for a crane this year. But one observation that was made, and it was made in, I guess, the late 80s or early 90s by an Aristophanes scholar, Rousseau identified that for Aristophanes, all the plays that use the mechane were Dionysia plays, and that none of the Lenaia plays use the mechane.
Mm.
And that was, I'll say, sort of independent of the flipping of the two plays from 411, the Thesmophoriadisai and the Lysistrata.
Mm.
Thesmo needs a crane, and now it's generally accepted that that is a Dionysia play. Lysistrata doesn't need the mechane. It's now generally accepted to be a Lenaia play.
Hmm.
That reversal of festivals for those two plays in the scholarship was made completely independent of the issue of the crane.
Hmm.
That wasn't being factored in. So that provides a little extra confirmation for Rousseau's hypothesis. But if Rousseau is right, Lenaia plays don't have the crane.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the rural Dionysia or the local Dionysia don't have the crane.
Yeah.
But that at least sometimes at the Dionysia, you do have the mechane.
Yeah.
And I think that also makes sense in terms of who's paying for it, that it's not a Kuregos expense, it's a festival expense, and so a city or archon expense, that it's something that is brought forward at one festival, but not at every festival, and typically not at the Lenaia or at the local festivals.
Yeah, it makes sense that it would be like the big budget festival, right? Like the City of Dionysia is the biggest one. It is one with the most plays performed. It is one with the highest budget. Like,
exactly.
Yeah, it just makes sense. I mean, because also I think I've sort of briefly talked about it in other episodes of the Dionysia was a big production, even beyond the productions, right? Like there was a whole procession through the city, and it was like a big city thing, more even than just a tragic festival, right? Like there was more going on around it. Is that right?
So yeah, this is one of the things that sort of the focus on social history that got introduced to scholarship in the late 80s, early 90s, sort of introduced, was seeing the Dionysia as an expression of Athenian civic identity.
Mm.
I think we're now moving more to an understanding of tragedy as being a Mediterranean-wide cultural export, and we see it arriving in different poles and different places at different times. And there's a focus now on tragedy in Sicily, tragedy on the Black Sea, all these things. But when scholarship was focused particularly on understanding the social history of Athens, there was some great work done that again pulls together disparate accounts that talk about things that are happening outside of the competition. So I can sort of run through some of those at least really quickly. Whether these happened every year, not all of them did. So we've got three tragedians each competing with a tetralogy on three separate days. It looks like we've got five comic playwrights, though it has been argued that during the Peloponnesian War, sometimes there were only three comic playwrights, that there was a reduction. We can talk about whether that makes sense or not. There's reasons to like that idea.
I mean, it seems to make sense just in terms of like money, just the basics of.
Well, also, who are the actors?
Right. Oh, gosh.
How many comic actors do you have kicking around town?
Yeah.
Are there really that many more goofy actors than serious actors? And that for me is where the numbers start multiplying. But you know, do you have the resources to adequately fund five different comedies at two different festivals throughout late 5th century? And it'd be great if you did. I like comedy, but there's reason to think it could be reduced to three in some cases. You also have, we've talked about the dithyrambs. So each of the 10 tribes puts forward two choruses of 50 men and 50 boys. Each of those and so each of those is a separate choregia. Each has a different choregos. But the dithyrambic contests are singing these narrative songs, but were they mimetic? Were they always mimetic, or sometimes in terms of people taking individual roles, or are they telling stories? We've got hints of these things. We can look at a couple of poems of Achilles to look at examples of dithyrambs, but I wouldn't feel comfortable fully generalizing as to what the content of all the dithyrambs always was. But again, this competitive context, in addition to the plays competing, both the tragic competition and the comic competition, there's the boys' dithyrambs and the men's dithyrambs all competing. There's a preview. This seems to have happened every year, at least once, certainly from the 440s on, at the Odeon. So the Odeon is this big building that's set up as part of the Periclean building program. It's a square building that sort of is right at budding the theater and even cutting into the wedge of where the audience sit. There's lots of pillars inside, so the sight lines aren't great, but it was in that building that the Proagone took place, which seems to have been sort of like a preview. These might have been trailers for the dramatic festivals that were to come. But we've got a story, for example, of when Euripides dies and Sophocles is competing in his old age, that he brings his actors out in mourning gear. So I think that took place at this Proagone, that this is the first time we're seeing the playwright, the didaskalos, the director, the actors. That's the time to show mourning for your fallen colleague. Because boy, does that get the sympathy votes then. Oh, how respectful.
Yeah.
Applaud, applaud. And it shows that he's honoring Euripides, but it's not something that's happening during the plays or is on the competition day itself.
Right.
This is making the public statement for a guy you've been competing with for 50 years, right? Like, they're genuine. I'm not trying to reduce the genuineness of his feeling for the loss of Euripides and the respect that he had for his fellow competitor. But there's a place to do that. And I think the place is in this Proagone. We actually know Aristophanes wrote a play called Proagone. It was produced in 422. Wouldn't it be great to have that? But just imagine the meta-theatrical jokes that are going on. About the event that people had just seen 3 days earlier.
Yeah.
And this is what the play seems to be about.
Yeah.
So all those things happen more or less every year. The other sort of cultural activities are, it's harder to quantify how frequent they are, but they could parade out the orphans that the city is paying for. And so you bring all the orphans into the orchestra, and then you get to clap for your city and the rearing of young people.
Really? Exactly. Now,
do you do that every year? Do you, it's just occasionally when the Archon wants to make a particular statement, you bring out the tribute. So again, the Athenian Empire is based on tribute from the polis, particularly in the islands.
Yeah.
And we've got tribute lists. We know roughly how much it was. I don't know the numbers at the top of my head.
Yeah.
But I once sort of did a back of the envelope calculation that if you allowed 1 square meter in a 25 meter wide orchestra that was roughly circular, you would have a talent for every square meter. So just filling up, even symbolically, just imagine, yes, you know, look at the wealth that Athens has inherited. Plunk, plunk, plunk. And you put down these bags, one beside each other per square meter. Fill, you know, however long that procedure takes place, that is a huge political message,
yeah,
that is sending. There are other ways that we can mark Athenian civic identity too. But that gives an idea of some of the things that maybe occurred, but it's like the entire festival is a cultural performance, mm-hmm, in addition to the individual entries in each of the competitions. And of course, in other cities, at other festivals, you have different types of competition. You might have music competitions, where Kitherodes, I think there's a Kitherode competition at Delphi. But again, what gets celebrated? What are the events that we care about? Different events get cared about at the Panathenaea. Mm-hmm. It's not a dramatic festival, but there we have athletic contests and we have musical contests there too. So thinking about the festival life and the cultural life of Athens and seeing the place of any individual play, in that, messages are being built that are completely separate from the content of the plays. Yeah. And that's not to denigrate or say the content of the plays is unimportant, but it makes its meaning in different ways. Mm-hmm. And some plays do get exported. And some of them seem to get exported fairly quickly. When we look at the comic vases from South Italy, the plays that we've been able to identify on the comic vases of South Italy aren't, again, these pan-Hellenic comedies. They're really Athena-centric ones. Hmm. They're ones that are drilling down. So, you know, either Thesmophoria Agisai of Aristophanes or Eupolis's Demes, where the chorus is made up of maybe individuated neighborhoods in Athens.
Wow, and that you makes it think to that Italy.
Well, this is it. You'd think that that was local interest only.
Yeah.
But what the cities in Magna Graecia are wanting to see is the stuff that's resonating with the Athenians.
Yeah.
And so we see that, you know, those plays have an afterlife. Tragedies have an afterlife too. And again, we talked about Helen and Andromeda. Mm-hmm. Andromeda certainly enters into the subsequent performance repertoire. Hmm. Helen seems not to. Helen doesn't Rude. Make it into the, but Andromeda was a great play. But again, they're entering into the performance repertoire separate from their original context.
Yeah.
As a pair of plays or as a tetralogy, individual plays get exported. And people cared about seeing Andromeda or Perseus fall in love at first sight with Andromeda. And it was that romantic story that captured the imagination of the painters who are painting South Italian vases in the 4th century that capture, you know, there's anecdotes from the Roman Empire about, you know, people touring productions of Andromeda. Andromeda, mm-hmm, we know, continued to be performed, at least in the Roman East. But in being performed, that is laying, it is cementing its position in the canon at the expense of other plays. Mm-hmm. When the Globe puts on Hamlet, when the original Globe put on Hamlet, what were the other plays that other playwrights put on that year? Mm-hmm. I'll say nobody cares.
Yeah.
Because that one play has sort of displaced the others in the cultural memory, or Lear, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But then again, maybe because, you know, a play didn't have quite the cachet it had originally, because it made it into the First Folio, say, mm-hmm. that might give it a prominence that it wouldn't have had otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so it still enters into the performance canon just a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But thinking about, recognizing that there's a narrowing of all the plays that get performed in subsequent performance, some of them are being used educationally. Some are being, you know, taught in schools. They're the Macbeth you read in grade 9 or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Some are entering into the performance life. Mm-hmm. And Iphigenia Among the Taurians is one of those that we know keeps being performed. Mm. Andromeda by Euripides is one we know keeps being performed through the Hellenistic period, through the 4th century, through the Hellenistic period into the Roman period.
And not long enough for us to have it.
It came close, though.
That's so interesting that one, so specifically, we know about its lasting nature, and then yet still it is a lost play. Like, I think that's such a great example of how we still, like, it doesn't matter how popular it was during certain time periods, like, sometimes it just won't make it to us.
Well, Eupolis's Deems is a comedy like that, too. Mm. We've got 3 pages. It was on a codex in Cairo in the 5th or 6th century CE. I don't remember which. But it made it into a book, mm-hmm. with Menander. Mm. And you know, here we are, late antiquity, almost on the verge of getting into the manuscript tradition. Mm-hmm. And Menander and Eupolis's Deems doesn't make it.
Yeah.
But we've got this one fragment. Well, it's a pretty extensive fragment. It's 3 pages of this codex from Deems, which is the play that we know was performed in South Italy in the 4th century. We can see it had a lasting impact. It was available to to authors like Lucian in the 2nd century CE, mm. when they are looking back at Attic drama. They're looking to plays like Frogs, to plays like Deems, mm-hmm. in terms of their comic inspiration. And so Deems is another one that almost made it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so interesting.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
I just am so obsessed with the idea of just all of the different things that had to happen for us to have things, have all of these surviving bits and pieces. So hearing about these specific ones we know were so popular and yet we don't have them. Just so fascinating.
So the story that we have for Andromeda. Mm. Well, first off, Andromeda is the play that that Dionysus is reading in Frogs.
Right.
That's what gives him the yearning for Euripides, is the yearning felt by Perseus falling in love. And so at the end of the 5th century, Andromeda is already being held up as this play for longing. We know that there's an anecdote about it being a scene being performed by Nicobule, who wrote anecdotes about Alexander getting drunk. And and that Alexander, the night of his final dinner, performed a scene that he had memorized from Euripides' Andromeda. Now, again,
wow.
It's not important whether that's true or not.
Yeah.
What's important is that when someone was telling stories about what Alexander would be doing on his last night,
mm-hmm.
that's what he'd focus on mm-hmm. in that person's mind. It might be true, but less, more interesting is the cultural place that Andromeda holds. That's the detail that gets preserved.
Yeah, like even if you're going to make it up, that play still holds the value for it to be the one that you've made up as this thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And then Lucian, writing in the 2nd century, has this weird story. So he's got this prose treatise on how to write history, and how to write history begins talking about. In the same way that Thucydides' history has the account of the plague of Athens, Lucian, a comic writer writing in Rome, or writing in the period Roman times, is doing a similar sort of thing and says a disease hit the town of Abdera. Now, Abdera is this town in the Eastern Empire.
Mm-hmm.
It was... there were Abderite jokes. They were the ones that you sort of target. So we've got a joke book from antiquity that has a whole section on Abderite jokes. So they're already, insert your favorite or least favorite ethnic identity here.
Yeah.
That's the role that the Abderites held for at least one joke teller. But so a plague hits Abdera, and people get a headache, they can't sleep, and it goes away and there's blood and all these things. And he's describing it in the same way that Thucydides describes the plague, but it affected their minds and they all had a yearning for tragedy while they were deathly sick. and they all begin delivering poetry while yelling. So they're all, you know, barfing up blood and all these things while delivering these lines of verse. And this is meant to be funny. This is this. I don't believe this is a historical event. But again, Lucian is choosing, you know, this yearning for tragedy. And in particularly, they would sing the songs from Euripides' Andromeda.
Wow.
Including the story of Perseus falling in love. And so I think there's a traveling actor, Archelaus. And it was his performance of Andromeda in the hot summer heat that makes everybody get sick. So again, just think about what that story is saying, that one, you know, you can go to a play, see someone lovesick and get sick yourself, that the fictional worlds represented are somehow contagious and permeable to the theater audience. I love that.
Yeah.
The fact that madness is associated both with physical illness, but also with a love of poetry. And
I
so,
mean,
you know,
Dionysus is Dionysus, right? Like, and that suits.
You know, Lord Byron had it right. But but it's a fascinating story. This is the story that he begins how to write history with. And again, it's I'm not saying this is historical. I think he's being funny here. But just the details that he's giving, he gives the name of a traveling actor. That's not going to be an accidental name. That's going to be the name of a prominent traveling actor in the second century.
Mm-hmm.
That he knows. The fact that Andromeda is being performed in the repertoire. The story isn't, whoa, and they performed Andromeda. No, this is what this is the marker that the entire city's gone insane, is that they're reciting at the top of their voices lines of Euripides. And we might even think of the story of the captured Athenian sailors after the Sicilian expedition, who supposedly
right.
get their freedom by singing songs of Euripides.
Yeah.
Maybe that's informing this story too, right? But again, just Andromeda has this place of, not for what's in it, really. You know, sure, it's a love story, but we still don't know what happened in the second half of the play.
Yeah.
But it holds, you know, one scene captured the imagination. The moment when Perseus falls in love with Andromeda while he's swinging from the Mykonae that somebody else is paying for.
Yeah.
That scene so captured the imagination that the play enters the performance repertoire, and whether it's being performed in excerpts, with music, with extra music, all that sort of thing, we don't know.
Yeah.
But we've got hints because we can see some indications of scripts.
Yeah. Well, I just made me think, like, just Andromeda generally, like, I know it's also, you know, one of the plays that's mentioned in Thesmophoriadusai. So it, like, there's like there's so many different levels that even I kind of had enough connection without even thinking of this, like, really long tradition of this lost play. Like, it just, it kind of is everywhere.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's painted on the walls, you know, frescoes in Pompeii mm-hmm. show versions of this story. Are they Euripides' versions? Well, maybe, but they're certainly part of the same cultural dialogue
mm-hmm.
Where stories from particular plays get preserved. And
yeah.
sometimes they're being preserved artistically. A lot of paintings, frescoes, terracottas. Sometimes they're being preserved through reperformance. And sometimes they're being preserved just, you know, as written examples, which we might think of as for educational use or because they're useful for pulling quotes in your law court speeches or whatever it is. Those, you know, there's different ways that a play might make it into an afterlife. But what are the filters that allow it to eventually enter the manuscript tradition?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that performance wasn't one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Performance doesn't get you into the manuscripts. It might help you live till the second century CE, but the cut from that point to what makes it into the manuscript tradition, let's see, Menander almost makes it in.
Mm-hmm.
But Iphigenia among the Taurians, for example, was also one of these reperform plays. We have it among the alphabetic plays, these randomly selected or accidentally selected plays, the eta through kappa of the complete works, not because they were chosen to be among the ones that survived. Whereas for Sophocles and Aeschylus, we've only got the ones that were chosen to survive. We can discriminate a little bit looking at the Euripides examples and see that Helen and the Iphigenia plays weren't picked.
So neither of Iphigenia were. Okay. No. I forgot to recheck that list before I started the Taurians. So thank you for pointing that out.
No worries at all.
Yeah.
But all of the H-I-K plays. So Heracles, Iphigenia, Helen, the two Iphigenias, Kyklops.
Yeah.
These ones survive accidentally.
Was that none of the, I thought the Heracles one for sure. That's so interesting.
No, it is. Uh-huh. And so exactly. Heracles and Helen are probably my favorite two extant Euripides plays.
Helen is amazing. I had no idea. And then I'll never forget that play. It's so good.
It is.
Yeah. I forget how I brought it up recently. I don't know why it came up. I think I bring it up when I possibly can, but just like the Menelaus wearing a fishnet is just like, I'm going to live with that forever. You know, it's so good. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we mentioned just roughly scripts. We've got little hints of how scripts work.
Oh, yeah.
We know that roles, for tragedies, you had three speaking actors. It was one of the ways that they created a level playing field for competition. And we have this one papyrus. And again, the papyrus is from Egypt. Is this representative of everything? Maybe not. But nevertheless, we don't have production materials, so we can only take what scraps we've got. But there's this one papyrus, Pioxy 4546. So it was found in Oxyrhynchus, and it's just got this Pioxy number, 4546. Mm-hmm. And it is from Euripides' Alcestis. But it's a great one. And it's only Admetus' lines. That survive. We've got the rest of the play. We can tell that there were other bits, but what this is what the actor had in his hand. And the actor learned just Admetus's lines and would wait for the other person to stop talking, and then they would talk. And you knew when each speech began, but you didn't write out for everybody's lines. Yeah. One, that's incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
Papyrus is expensive. Copying is expensive. So you give the actors are literate.
Yeah.
So it's important evidence for literacy.
Yeah.
You give them their part. And we talk about parts using terms from Elizabethan theater and Jacobean theater, where actors, again, got their part. They got the lines that they say, not the lines that other people say. But that seems to have been the case, at least for this production of Alcestis. For other sort of backstage documents, we actually don't have them for theater. They must have existed.
Yeah.
But we do have them for other performance traditions, particularly for mime. Ancient mime isn't what we think of, Marcel Marceau, but it's an unmasked performance tradition. With small troops, they still got musical instruments. They can have a couple of people on stage, but it's unmasked and women could perform.
Whoa!
But yeah, I know it. We whole other podcast. we can talk about that some other time.
Toss that one away.
Yeah, this was the genre that women could perform. This was the dramatic genre that women could perform in.
Yeah.
But we've got scraps of things like a running list. So over the course of a given production, there were these seven different playlets, and they're all named like Friends episodes. The one about the Goths, the one with the rain, the one with the sunshine. And so we've got the running list of seven different little playlets or mimes that are going to be put on, and then a props list.
Yeah.
And again, if you've worked in the theater, you know backstage there's all sorts of documents that on closing night get scrunched up and thrown away.
Yeah.
It just happens that it was thrown away in a dump that got excavated 1,600 years later. And so we've got a props list. There's also one papyrus that looks like a cue list. So it's the lines that the other person's going to say to lead you into your speech.
Yeah.
And again, this is a different performance tradition, hundreds of years separated from classical Athens. So I'm not suggesting necessarily this exact thing existed in Athens, but there would have been documents.
Mm-hmm.
And the ephemera of theater production, even the written documents that existed backstage, they're not things that are entering into the manuscript tradition. They're not things that are being saved in the library at the Metro. They're not things that are being kept around, but they're documents that are used.
Yeah.
Who has them? Who gets a copy of the full play before production? Maybe, you know, this also cuts down on leaks if you only have your own words that you're going to be saying. But it does suggest that the three actors who are splitting all the roles have parts with their lines. They don't have the complete play. I think there's no reason for most of the choristers to have a complete play.
Yeah.
Plutarch gives us an anecdote about how rehearsals worked with Euripides singing a line and then the chorus singing it back. Now, again, the point of the anecdote, this is the great thing with anecdotes. They don't need to be true to be useful for us. We can, the point isn't this is the way Euripides taught, can you believe it? Euripides taught this way. The point of the anecdote was that he was using a funny musical mode and one of the choristers laughs at him. So he's doing this call and response and Euripides sings the line using the Mixolydian mode and one of the choristers giggles. And Euripides says, how dare you snicker when I sing in the Mixolydian mode, or whatever he sounded like. But all that presumes this sort of call and response training from the Didaskalos, the director. That's what Euripides is celebrated for, from the director to the chorus.
Yeah.
That they learn by memory, hearing the music. Choristers aren't being given a script, and choristers don't need to be literate.
Yeah.
Not everyone in a production needs to be able to read.
Yeah.
I think the actors do need to be able to read, though.
Yeah.
And so, again, there's a reason that some of them are separated and celebrated for one thing. Others are winning actors' prizes.
Yeah.
Because there are different sets of skills.
Ah. Okay, I have endless questions, but I also don't want to keep you too long. I would love to know if anything, maybe not anything, because we'll try to limit it. But I would love to touch upon the actors themselves, if we can, and just briefly, who was and was not allowed to watch the plays, because I know that's a question that comes up a lot. So yeah, whatever you can tell me in a brief period of time while I still have you would be so amazing.
Sure. Okay, so very quickly.
Yeah.
We honestly don't know all that much about the actors in the original productions. The actors begin to get a prize also in the 440s. And when the actors' prizes are introduced is a little bit of a thorny scholarly issue, but some actors' prizes begin in the 440s. Some come later for both comedy and tragedy, Linnaea, Dionysia. Eventually, by the end of the 4th century, there's prizes across the board. But how quickly they all come in, we don't know. We've got individual names. They probably were brought on board to a production in a set of three. So you know who it is. You know, they know who they're working with. And probably if you won the prize the previous year, you've got the right to get in for free. But it's not always clear to me that the playwrights get to choose who their actors are. That might be one of the allotted features. So we've got individual names. Sometimes the names are because of mistakes that they made. We know of one actor who, in the course of Euripides' Orestes in 408, mispronounced a breathing in one word. It's not even a breathing. It's an elision in one word. And apparently it just made the audience guffaw, and the comic playwrights didn't let him off the hook. Aristophanes makes jokes about it. Stratus, another comic playwright, makes jokes about it, and maybe a third one does as well. I'm just not producing who it is. But the cult of the actors start to develop in the 440s, continue through the 5th century. And I think the actors really come into their own around 386. Because in 386, at the Dionysia, a new contest gets introduced. And the new contest is putting on old tragedies. So in addition to the modern tragedies, new playwrights every year, you have an option to put on one of the classics. And one of the classics was a play by one of the big three. This helped set the performance repertoire that we talked about in the 4th century. Maybe it didn't happen every year. It happens every year by about 340, I think it is. But in those, but 386 is the first time we get this sort of state-sponsored old tragedies competition. And that's going to be because the actor wants to play one of the great roles.
Yeah.
The actor wants to be Helen, or wants to be Euripides as Helen.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting, particularly for the people still writing new tragedies. That changes what it is to write a Medea play if elsewhere in the competition, someone's going to maybe be putting on Euripides as Medea.
Yeah.
So if there's an onus for innovation then. There's an onus for creativity if you're writing new plays, for breaking the mold, for doing wild, radical things, which is what we think 4th century tragedy did. But we can see that developing out of pressures from the instantiation of a classics competition.
Yeah.
But the plays that make it into the classics competition are Orestes, Andromeda, things like that. They're the ones that are going to be reperformed. Heracles is another one that we know gets reperformed.
That's so interesting. I just, it's endlessly fascinating, obviously. Yeah, I will try to wrap up. This, yeah.
Oh, you want to know about the audience too.
If we can tell, like, so the only thing I know is that, like, I know there's just debate about whether any woman was there, or if she was there, was she a quote unquote hetera? But then I have this whole issue with, like, okay, who is actually a hetera and who is just a woman in a space?
Let's not frame it in terms of whether you're a sex worker.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's not helping. Whether there are women there or not, the notional audience of the playwrights is male.
Because it's
when they address the crowd, they are addressed as if they were jurors, an all-male group, or the ecclesia, an all-male group. So when we break whatever is maintaining any semblance of dramatic illusion, the group address is always to a male group. I think always to a male group. Maybe there's exceptions, but so the notional audience is male. But I can't believe that there aren't women in the audience. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence. There's articles by Jeff Henderson and Tony Podlecki, both of which conclude that there are likely some women in the audience. But it's distinguishing the actual audience composition, where, you know, you might be bringing your whole family to the theater, you've brought them into the city, or, you know, this is how you're entertaining yourself when you're dispossessed of your land because there's a war on, or whatever it is. If you've got money to spare, you might bring more people, but it costs more. And so not everyone is going to be bringing their wife. Not everyone is going to be bringing whatever woman is in their life. I think framing it that way, could women go in groups by themselves? Of course, they probably could. We don't hear about that, though. We do hear about it in Rome. We know there's an incredible diversity in the audiences of Rome. The plays attest to that. So we know what that kind of evidence could look like. But we're left with, you know, tantalizing hints, again, often from comic playwrights. In Aristophanes' Birds, there's a suggestion that women will fly away home after or during a play in order to spend time with their lovers. Well, first off, married women aren't supposed to have lovers in the normative expectations for civic virtue within Athens. So it's not, that's really what they're doing. Is the joke that there are women in the, well, no, the joke is that they're carrying on while their husbands are staying in the theater, that seems to imply that women could be in the audience, but it doesn't, it falls short of proof, right? So, you know, you build up, you know, you look at all those sorts of hinted at examples. For me, it leads me to believe that there were women in the audience, but that they're not a prominent group within the audience, and that the group is treated as if it's all men, because it's men who are doing the voting. It's men who are the judges, who are used to all male engagements. Maybe the women, it's being suggested sometimes that they sit at the back. Sitting at the back is actually pretty good viewing. You get to see the top-down view of the chorus then.
Yeah, the sound is great.
Which you miss. And so, I think that we don't want to start assuming, well, we know that there's sexism happening in Athens. I'm not trying to deny that. But we don't need to just sort of import our own way of enacting sexism onto the Athenians. They found their own ways to be sexist.
They were really good at it.
They really were, and they worked hard at it. But that being the case, that's not saying one way or the other whether women were in the audience. So I don't know. My gut is that they were there, just not in great numbers.
Yeah. No, honestly, that's a great way of just like looking at the possibilities, which frankly is really what I wanted to hear, because I've read things of this kind of broad statement of like no women, and I'm like, that seems impossible, unlikely, like ridiculous. Like, I know Athens was absurd, but like, come on. So I'm glad to hear that's kind of like a notion of just like, hey, you know, why say definitely not? Like, this came up in a conversation I had recently where the idea of saying that something absolutely did not happen based on ancient evidence seems utterly absurd broadly. Like,
because we have so little evidence.
Yeah.
In any case, you can't prove a negative. One other piece of evidence that is sort of relevant, I guess, is Aristophanes' Ecclesia Zeusae, in which women sneak into the ecclesia. They sneak into the assembly, which was an all-male space. Now, do we have plays of women sneaking into the theater? We don't know of any. If we did, that would be evidence that women weren't normally allowed. We do, though, have lost comedies. We've got the Proagone. What are the roles of women in the Proagone that we talked about? The preview festival. Were the women there? What? You know, what? Who knows? Nobody is the answer to that rhetorical question. But there's also a comedy of Aristophanes, women setting up tents, or women setting up the skene, the stage building. That could be a woman sneaking into the festival. If you wanted to make an exclusion of women from theater, I'd look at that play and start making up a plot that has them sneaking in. But I don't think that's what the evidence shows.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. And Aristophanes said some wild stuff, so, you know, who knows with him?
You never know. But I hope that's useful for you. I hope that's what you wanted. Yeah.
Like, absolutely. I mean, I knew this conversation was going to be great, but no. So good. No, every question it was answered in great detail. So thank you so much. This was so much fun. I don't know if you want to share anything with my listeners in terms of reading more or finding more, anything of that type. It's fine if not too.
You know, there's a lot of really great work being done, particularly on the Deme theaters and the additional competitions, both in Attica and in the wider Mediterranean. The work of Peter Wilson and Eric Schapo, C-S-A-P-O, they write together, and they've got some fantastic stuff that's really opening up new worlds for understanding the place that theater had, Greek theater had, Athenian theater had, in the wider Mediterranean.
Oh, that's so exciting. Well, I'm going to go look up those names anyway, so that's wonderful.
There we are.
Thank you so much for joining me again. This was, like, truly so much fun.
It's great talking with you.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, nerds, thank you so much for listening, as always. I won't try to say more today. It was a joy of a conversation. Thank you to Toph for speaking to me, and it was just absolutely wonderful. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, better known as the assistant producer. Laura Smith is now the production assistant and audio engineer. She's making my life easier with those conversations, I will tell you. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. Thank you all. As always, you are the best. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.